Irving. Play by Porzingis gets the shot off and hit.
Kyrie Irving is an amazing basketball player.
Irving, straight on three. Bang! Kyrie Irving.
Who made quite a stir earlier this year regarding the flat Earth theory.
Ben Nichols, this is a shout out to you. He came to us. He listens to super conspiracy theory guy.
This is not even conspiracy.
The Earth is flat.
Yeah, no, the Earth is flat.
Oh, here we go.
The Earth is flat. Earth is flat.
Now, don't get me wrong. There's no way a bright Duke University educated guy like Kyrie Irving should fall for something anyone can debunk with the United Airlines timetable and some common sense. But take a minute to understand how he formed his opinion.
Hopefully they'll either back my belief or they'll kind of throw it in the water. I think it's interesting for people to find out.
You've seen pictures of the planet, though, right? Like, yeah. It's a circle. So
I've seen a lot of things that that my educational system has said that was real and turned out to be completely fake. So, I mean, I don't mind. I don't mind going against the grain in terms of my thoughts. But I mean,
and with that, you might begin to understand why today's guest, Dr. Henry Bauer, might cut Kyrie some slack.
The popular view of science has not caught up with the present situation where people should be as skeptical about what official science says as they are about what the experts say about any other aspect of society.
Now, like I said, the Kyrie Irving flat Earth thing caused quite a stir.
Did you know that the Earth is flat? Kyrie Irving is unfortunately helping to spread the conspiracy.
Here's a meme that was played over and over again by the mainstream science media.
His students, thanks to Irving, staunchly believe that the world is flat, Girl remarked, and immediately I started to panic. How have I failed these kids so badly?
Yes, panic indeed. How else should a science teacher respond to students that don't just, well, believe everything they're told?
It's definitely hard for me because it feels like science isn't real to them. The educator said that he has tried to get the students to understand that the world is indeed round to no avail. The influence of Irving was just too strong.
I did ask Henry about this. Because that's what I think happens. See, I think people have this growing sense that they're being lied to, manipulated, and bullshitted by science, right? And they don't know quite how to articulate it. So something like Flat Earth comes along, and some guy sounds halfway like he knows what he's talking about, and people are like, you know what? I'm open to hearing it.
We have to be skeptical about what scientists say, because what scientists tell you is not necessarily the same as what science can tell you.
You think you're original? You ain't original. You were programmed to be you. You're a slave and you don't even know it. Shit you think of ain't even your thoughts. Let's step out the box for a minute. Yo, how do we know if God exists? How do we know it's positive? Are you the definition of an angel or the opposite? If you lost your wallet and I found it...
Stick around. My interview with Dr. Henry Bauer is up next on Skeptico. Today we welcome Dr. Henry Bauer back to Skeptico to talk about his new book, Science is Not What You Think, How It Has Changed, Why We Can't Trust It, and How It Can Be Fixed. Now, in case you don't remember, my first interview with Dr. Bauer, who was a professor of chemistry and science studies at Virginia Tech, and eventually wound up as the dean of arts and sciences, which, as you can imagine, I'm sure gave him an interesting perspective, a broad perspective on academia beyond his specialization in chemistry. But if you don't remember, you're going to be reminded of this kind of interesting career he's had, and particularly how he's thrown his hat in the ring for this challenge of reforming science. Henry, welcome back to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Alex. It's good to be there.
So I briefly sketched out your background. Tell folks more about who you are and what led you to write this book, which may sound a little bit like the last book about dogmatic science, but has some new interesting twists to it as well.
Right, thanks. I was turned on to science in high school, and I studied chemistry, and I taught chemistry and did research in chemistry.
I asked you for a synopsis of Science Is Not What You Think, your latest book, and you gave me what I think is a pretty good one. Here's how I heard it. You said science is pervasive in our society, but it's also widely misunderstood in terms of how science works, and this has led to the manipulation of public policy. So I was hoping you could kind of elaborate on that as kind of encapsulating what you're where you're really coming from.
Exactly. Thank you. The thing is that even as science is accepted as being the hallmark of true understanding, the fact of the matter is the history of science shows quite clearly that a scientific consensus at any point in time can't be accepted as absolutely correct.
Early on in the book, you identify some mistaken beliefs about science that I really think get to the heart of what you're trying to convey. Let's start with this one. Science is not skeptical. Now, that's one that's going to catch a lot of people off guard. Tell folks what you mean by that.
I saw this at first hand when I was doing chemistry also. When you're first fooling around and you're looking into new things, you gather data, you look at stuff, and then you develop a theory. And while this is going on, you could maybe say that people are pretty skeptical in the sense that we argue with one another about what the best explanation is. But once an explanation has been largely accepted within the research community, people are no longer skeptical when they do experiments. They take that theory as correct. They don't question it anymore. So in the book, I say science has a love-hate relationship with the evidence. We love it as we are gathering it, and then afterwards we hate any evidence that goes against the theory that we've accepted.
That's well said. And, you know, the other way I kind of took it from the book is that science isn't any particularly any more skeptical than any other field. I mean, they're skeptical when it suits them, and they're not skeptical when it suits them to be not skeptical. So this idea that science is at every turn questioning every aspect of every experiment and every conclusion is a mistaken belief that leads to this overconfidence that we have in science.
Yeah, exactly. And really, science is done by human beings, and human beings are not inherently skeptical all the time. And science reflects human characteristics and social characteristics.
Here's another one of those mistaken beliefs from your book, and I think it's related to the first one. Science is self-correcting. And you hear this all the time when you pin somebody down and you really say, look, clearly we've gone off the rails in this direction. The data, I've run into this time and time again with parapsychology and psi experiments where I go, okay, the guy repeated it. He repeated it 9 times at 3 different labs, 27 labs now across the world. Well, you know what? If it's true, it will correct itself because science is self-correcting. Do you want to elaborate on how that is not really that meaningful?
I love that one because on the one hand, we have the scientific method, which supposedly says that we don't accept theories until the evidence has proved them. On the other hand, we say science is self-correcting. Well, if it was right the first time, right, why does it need self-correction? And the if it is self-correcting, that is an admission that a scientific consensus at any particular time can't be given too much credence.
You know, that reminds me of the kind of other extreme of that, which I always bring up because it always just amazes me when I hear it. And that's the old extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And I always want to go, do you realize how completely unscientific that saying is? That this idea that there should be this meta body that decides what's extraordinary in terms of claims and what's extraordinary into proof completely undermines the whole purpose of science, which was to remove us from these biases. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, extraordinary is a matter of judgment, isn't it? So it's a meaningless statement to start with.
Exactly. But the fact that it resonates with people, I think, gets back to your point and the point of the book, Science is Not What You Think. People think that's what science is supposed to do, kind of police thought and kind of regulate what's extraordinary and what's not. And what I hear you saying is the real purpose of science is something completely different than that. It's to kind of find a way that we can navigate in as unbiased way as possible these new areas of understanding and these new aspects of our environment that we find. And we can't do that if we let all these biases in.
Well, that's right. And one of the main points I make in the book is how drastically scientific activity has changed, in particular around the time of the Second World War, mid-20th century. I think up to then, it wouldn't have been all that wrong to say that science is a fairly independent activity that tries to discover or get the best understanding of how the world works. But the Second World War, the atomic bomb, and all the other things like radar started this era in which science is involved in just about everything. I mean, medicine is said to be scientifically based, or seeks to be scientifically based. And there's been an enormous expansion of money going into scientific research, so that nowadays what you find is that the activity of doing research is actually being controlled from the outside. It is no longer independent people curious about how the world works, looking into stuff.
I want to build on that point a little bit by going back to the first part of where you started, because I think it's really interesting. And we were chatting just a tiny bit before the show about the history of science and how that can be a turnoff to people. You know, you can just turn them off and say, oh, I'm not really that interested. I'm more interested in what's coming next. And we're all excited about advances and stuff like that. But I love how you've tried to identify the root cause or some of the root causes of this problem. And the problem, as it turns out, as you identify it, is dysfunctional, excessive growth. And if that is the problem, I think you've done an awesome job of putting your finger on this whole turn of history that you just alluded to in terms of it's World War II. We're all unbelievably excited and proud that we've conquered the world, and radar has been key to keeping England from being completely destroyed. That's the only way they survived. And then this atom bomb thing that these scientists got together and figured out that actually won the war. You know, this is the narrative that we're all told. So we can understand the enthusiasm that people had to say, well, heck, let's just give all the power and the glory to science and see where it goes. But take us through how that led to this dysfunctional, excessive growth that you're talking about. How did that lead to that?
There was a key one was that Vannevar Bush wrote a report to the president about the marvels that science had accomplished during the war, and pointing out that if this were applied to society as a whole, think what we could do. And that's when the National Science Foundation was founded, and when the National Institutes of Health experienced an enormous increase in budget. Federal funds flowed into science, and when I came to the States in the mid-60s, it was wonderful to be a scientist because all you had to do was to write a grant proposal. It would be definitely funded, and away you go. Well, the government was also funding scholarships for people to study science and get into science. And they wanted then to take up positions doing research. And in the space of about 10 years, there had been so many science PhDs produced that the demand for research funds began to exceed the supply.
Now, I really like, and I want to point out to people, how you're using these economic market force terms as it applies to science, because I think it takes us in a different place that makes this so much more understandable. So continue with the story of what happens when we have an oversupply in the market. What happens?
You get competition becoming more and more fierce. And as competition gets fierce, human beings start to maybe fudge a little bit, cut corners and so on. And around 1980, there was a book published by two science journalists, Broad and Wade, called Fraud and Deceit in the Halls of Science. And they claimed that dishonesty was an inherent part of scientific activity. Now imagine, traditionally, science had been regarded as about as honest an endeavor as you could ever find. And here were people saying that the absolute contrary, that fraud and deceit were inherent in it. The scientific community, and that includes me, did not take kindly to that book. But as it turns out, they had noticed something that was really going on.
Give folks an example of the kind of things that are going on, because in general terms, okay, there's more competition, there's more cutting of corners, there's also more just kind of jockeying for position. I have a grant of $20 million to study nuclear fission, and I'm at MIT. Somebody like these yahoos from Utah come out with a cold fusion thing. I'm like, I got to submarine that research no matter what, because my $20 or $30 million funding over here is going to go away. Now, I just introduced a whole other topic, but I mean, that's the kind of thing that goes on and on. If I see a threat to my research and I know that the budget is going down on a year-to-year basis, hey, I have to do whatever the heck I have to protect my budget, to heck with these ideals of science. I got to make sure I have a job next year and get the kids off to college, right?
Right. And you know, peer review is another thing that's generally seems to be regarded as a guarantee of the soundness of science. But peer review means colleagues and competitors judging one another's work. And they are not going to take kindly to giving money to things that to projects for other people when they want it themselves.
I think we covered the market forces And everyone has a sense that that's a reality. Particularly, it's come out more clearly in medical science, right? So now it's just well known. If you just put your money down, you can get a medical study from some quote-unquote prominent university to say just about anything you want with a little bit of finagling and, you know, adjusting here and there. But there's another aspect of this that I don't know that you – I know you've encountered. I don't know if you want to touch on, but I want to try and pull you into it because – I think another root cause of this problem is that the social prestige that science gained after this World War II period and right up to the present has made it irresistible for special interest groups, but also for people who are interested in controlling and shaping culture. If you want to sell nuclear power, we get it. You put a scientist in a lab coat and have them talk about their recent study that says it's really safe and you don't have to worry about it. That works because the prestige that science has influences people. But I think it's also there, and you touched on this a minute ago with the Vannevar Bush thing. If I want to change people's attitudes about feminism or drug use or drug abuse or civil rights or anything, I can play the same trick. I can put a guy in a lab coat and have him drag out some study and talk about it. And the prestige of science gets dragged along to and attached to my issue. And isn't that worrisome that it can be used so effectively in shaping culture?
It is absolutely worrying, and really that's in a sense the reason why I wanted to publish this book, that for people to begin maybe to understand that the prestige of science currently is based on things that happened quite some time ago, and the popular view of science has not caught up with the present situation where people should be as skeptical about what official science says as they are about what the experts, official experts, say about economics or sociology or any other aspect of society, because science is no longer a disinterested search for the truth. One of the chapters in the book is about statistics, and of course that's where people are able to manipulate results exactly as they want them all the time. Sociologists know perfectly well that they can get any result they want from a survey just by the manner in which you phrase the questions.
Undoubtedly, that's true, and we all understand how statistics can be manipulated in that way. But I also go back to something you said earlier about the people, because that's one thing I've encountered. It's really about the people, too. So we all think we're data-driven, or at least if we're scientifically minded, we're data-driven. But we're not in a lot of cases. We have these beliefs, and they drive us. We have motivations. We have hidden motivations that we don't tell people about. And I'm reminded of the old expression, you can't tell the players without a scorecard, because sometimes that's really the case. So
you see, with the high status of science, temptation has become very strong because you can become famous and you can become wealthy if you get in the right way.
You know, and I was going to draw your attention to kind of a new one that's got everyone's attention lately is the social justice warrior, right? The way the social justice warrior is processing science is really interesting and important to look at because, number one, they're using it as a weapon. You know, they're using it as a weapon to advance their cause. And they're using it also as a position statement. You know, it's not an ongoing evolving thing where people, where scientists are trying to arrive at some sort of truth. No, it's a position statement and a weapon for my argument. And that's the only thing it's good for. So no one can challenge me on the data because I'm not really interested in it in that way. I'm interested in some position statement that I can pound over someone's head. Well, what are you, do you have any thoughts on how the social justice warriors are using science, for example, in the global warming situation?
Well, I think the global warming thing is an excellent example of that, because I suspect that a considerable number of the activists on the carbon dioxide thing are people who had an environmental agenda to start with, and it's not that easy to get people excited about preserving the environment, but if you can scare them to death with the possibility of floods, tornadoes, and unstoppable climate change, then maybe you can get some of your other environmental things going the way you want them to.
What about folks who say, what's wrong with that, Henry?
Well, I think it is ultimately a self-destructive strategy to try to achieve something by telling lies, because they may catch up with you, and then they may overreact against your whole, in this case, environmental agenda.
Which we may agree with. I mean, I think I agree. I'm an environmentalist. I think we have to be very careful with the planet. I'm very concerned with pollution, with overpopulation, with all the things that could significantly reduce our quality of life. I just think the global warming thing is bullshit because the data doesn't support it. That's my thing.
Well, I also am very keen to preserve as much of nature as is possible. And I think that burning fossil fuels is a very bad idea, not because of the CO2, but because of something much more pernicious, which is that every time you burn coal and oil, what you're spreading into the environment are tiny traces of heavy metals, mercury amongst them. And that stuff, it doesn't remain in trace amounts in the environment. It gets accumulated in living organisms. And, you know, we've had some scares about mercury in fish, for example. And lead coming from when we used to add lead additives to gasoline. But these are only examples of what happens inevitably as we burn the fossil fuels. So I'm all in favor of getting rid of fossil fuel energy sources as soon as is feasible. But I don't think we should do it by telling lies about the danger coming from carbon dioxide.
You know, and that leads to a really interesting, important, and difficult point that I wanted to dive into, and that is the science policy link. And you talk about this in the book throughout, and that is, you know, when you look at how science informs people who make policy decisions, it gets really mucky, cloudy, and in a lot of ways, it gets very depressing. Because if you look at the social justice warrior who can't, they've doubled down. They have they've doubled their problem because one, they don't seem to be able or willing to sort through the scientific data. Like we just said, like with global warming, it's really not that hard. The best measure we have of temperature is these satellites. And that's what everyone relied on, including Al Gore, who stood up there in front of us. He said, hey, here's the best measure we have. It's these satellites, and they're telling us that the temperature is rising, right? And then 20 years later, Those same satellites told us, well, the temperature has leveled off and carbon has continued to rise. So anyone with a fifth grade science understanding says, okay, well, that theory turned out not to be true. That's okay. Theories come and go, but that theory clearly needs some work. Again, the social justice warrior manages to just kind of blind all that from their sight, can't sort through the data. But what I really wanted to get to is the double down thing is they also aren't willing to think through the policy kind of things. As I mentioned, you know, in this interview that I had with Daniel Pinchbeck, you know, here's his policy. His policy idea is that everyone should have a plant-based diet in order to cut down on greenhouse gases. Now, I'm mostly vegetarian. I eat very little meat. But I would never in a million years believe that from a policy standpoint, I could talk everyone into turning into a vegetarian or a vegan, or that I would make that a kind of a policy thing. I'd say, well, that is never going to happen, or it's going to happen lifetimes and lifetimes in the future. So, you know, there's this gap, I think, between not only between understanding the science, but then understanding how science might inform reasonable policies. And when I say reasonable, policies that would pass the test of our Republican system, democracy, where we vote on stuff.
Right. And I mean, the most important point really is how can we make it possible for policymakers to benefit from the best possible scientific advice, objective scientific advice. A fellow has written a book called The Honest Broker, in which he says the role of science ought to be to present policymakers with the pros and cons, because it is rarely, if ever, totally cut and dried. I suggest at the end of my book that it's time for something like a science court in which the pros and cons of scientific issues where there is disagreement should be publicly argued, so that the general public and the policymakers can see for themselves how much, what sort of evidence is there on the two sides. And the present system we have, where dissenting views from the scientific consensus, dissenting views are suppressed, and many people don't even know that there is dissent from them at all. This is very dangerous. The idea for a science court goes back about 50 years to the time when people were arguing whether nuclear reactors, power reactors, could be safe or not. And there were experts arguing both sides, and the issue was never resolved to the extent that policymakers could be fairly clear about what the probabilities of risks were. And we need that nowadays, because policymakers are often unaware that there are serious scientific issues about the carbon dioxide hypothesis. People nowadays base their opinions about carbon dioxide not on the science, but on their political views.
Well, that's by design. I love the idea. I mean, anyone loves the idea, because it suggests that we could actually rise above these special interests and other forces that are in play. But, you know, I recently had a chance, and I sent you a clip of this, but I recently had a chance to interview Dr. Jacques Vallée, who's best known, of course, for his UFO research, but is in fact a very well-rounded scientist, highly respected. And I don't want to get into the UFO research. It's a huge topic to try and cover, and it's not really your thing, although I know you've looked into it with your work at the Society for Scientific Investigation. But what I wanted to do was point to it as an example of the disinformation and misinformation factor, because it's stark. I mean, it's just clearly well documented that scientifically there was an organized, concerted effort to spread disinformation and misinformation about these UFOs. And so take out what you think about UFOs and just look at how science and scientists, and this is one of Valet's points in the interview, is the main point, is that scientists were intentionally misled. And again, I think that is so clearly documented that if anyone looks into it, what I hope they'd ask is the larger question that relates to your book, and I think also maybe challenges this idea of a science court, and that is that if they can do it, and if they're doing it that completely in this area, why would we suspect that they're not doing it in every area that matters? So, or AIDS, medicine, whatever. They're messing with the system in this very covert way with these tactics that they've refined of misinformation and disinformation, aren't they?
Sure. And, you know, people in power can find all sorts of rationalizations as to why they suppress other people's points of view. For that matter, you know, the story of Galileo and the church is often presented as science versus the church. But actually, the Pope didn't like what Galileo was doing because he was challenging authority. And if you challenge the authority of our scientific establishment, then they will react just as badly as the Pope or the Catholic Church reacted against challenges to its doctrines on everything, not just theological doctrines, but what they were saying about how the world works, about the science. And that's what you find nowadays in the same sort of way, that people who are in charge of the National Institutes of Health, for example, they are vested. Their careers, their lives, their status, their prestige is vested in what the institutes claim is the truth about medical matters. And they will do a resort to anything, any tactic at all, to maintain that position. I have a quote somewhere or other from Anthony Fauci and from Robert Gallo telling journalists that they may lose any access to official sources if they don't toe the ideological line of what they're putting out.
I think it's a wonderful analogy that you make both in the book and here between Galileo, because as the story is retold and retold, it's like this science triumphing over religion. And as you so beautifully put, our situation today is in many respects not that much different in terms of the challenges to authority and how those are suppressed and put down.
Right. And, you know, I in high school, I was turned on by science and regarded it as the ideal of the best sort of activity one could ever get involved in. And I must say that it is quite depressing and saddening for me to see what has happened to scientific activity nowadays. It's been corrupted and co-opted by outside interests. You have just turn on your television and you see the ads by pharmaceutical companies flogging things like Invokana and Xarelto, and you just have to wait a little bit longer and you see advertisements by legal firms for class action suits about the harm that those very things have done.
What we can do, though, is try and counter that message with an alternative message. And that's what I think you've done so beautifully. Again, our guest has been Dr. Henry Bauer. His new book that you're definitely going to want to check out, it will give you the ammo you need to kind of support this underlying feeling you have. Because there's this growing sentiment of distrust of science that I think is really going on. In a lot of ways, it's troubling because it hasn't quite had the legs to really stand up and be heard. But this book, Science Is Not What You Think, How It's Changed, Why We Can't Trust It, and How It Can Be Fixed, might give you that ammo you need to really say, well wait a minute, this is why I have grown to distrust science. This is why I fell for the flat earth theory the first time I heard it. See, that's what I think. Because that's what I think happens. See, I think people have this growing sense that they're being lied to, manipulated, and bullshitted by science, right? And they don't know quite how to articulate it. So something like flat earth comes along, and some guy sounds halfway like he knows what he's talking about. And people are like, you know what? I'm open to it because I know they're lying about this. I know they're lying about this. So I'm open to hearing it. When, you know, that's a big misstep too, because clearly anyone who spends 30 minutes in their backyard at sunset is going to be able to kind of figure out that the flat earth doesn't really hold on, or gets the airline charts out, you know, can figure that out. But it's the general mistrust of science that people can't quite articulate is, I think, the gap that I hope you're able to fill with this book. Do you have any thoughts, any final thoughts on that, Henry?
No, you put that very well. I mean, at the moment, I think a lot of people's skepticism about science is based on what they hear from political people who have something against science on the basis of their political views. And I hope that people can get from my book a healthy skepticism based on actualities, not that science is to be ignored altogether, but that we have to be skeptical about what scientists say, because what scientists tell you is not necessarily the same as what science can tell you.
Thanks again to Dr. Henry Bauer for joining me today on Skeptico. You know, there's one part of this interview that didn't make it into the show, and I wanted to add it back in because I think it's a really interesting little piece of information that's hanging out there. Now, in the last interview with Henry, we talked about it. It has to do with the connection between HIV and AIDS, or at the very least, HIV testing and AIDS. And I think it's just a beautiful example of how science has become corrupted in the way that Dr. Bauer is talking about. So the last time he was on the show, you know, we kind of talked about this ridiculous stat that you can get right from the UN data that says African-American women are 20 times more likely to be HIV positive than the general population. And this is kind of ridiculously subtly racist if you don't just challenge that and say, well, that doesn't make any sense. You know, they're not more promiscuous than the general population. We have sociological data on that. They're not more frequently using intravenous drugs. I mean, it just doesn't fit with what we're told about this whole HIV-AIDS connection. And then he kind of had another little snippet about that from this last interview that I wanted to include. So I'll just add it in here. I think it's kind of interesting.
When the Army in the United States started to test potential recruits for HIV, they found that all across the country, teenage female potential recruits were testing HIV positive as often as male teenage recruits. And that was impossible because HIV was said to have come to the United States at the latest in the late 1970s, and to have entered the States in closed communities of gay men in large metropolitan areas. So it was impossible that in half a dozen years' time, this supposedly sexually infective virus could have spread in such a way that teenage girls all over the country were testing positive more often than males.
So again, another point on the same, you know, the guy isn't saying that AIDS isn't real, or he's just saying, look at the numbers. Why isn't someone asking the hard questions about the numbers and why they don't add up in terms of this presumption we have that the HIV testing really makes any sense? I think it's an excellent point, and it leads to maybe the one question I tee up from this interview, and that is, what do you make of this claim that science is corrupted? How bad is it, I guess, would be the question. It's kind of the ongoing question on Skeptico, but Dr. Bauer's brought it into focus here, so we can talk about it some more. Let me know your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website, S-K-E-P-T-I-K-O. You can download any of the 350 previous shows. You can join the forum. We have some new people who are joining the forum, which is fun. We kind of changed who we let in there. I wasn't liking the kind of vibe. I mean, forums these days on the net can get just kind of funky. I just want people who are interested in the show and interested in talking about real topics, sharing information, sharing links, sharing ideas related to the show. So we've kind of channeled it over in that direction. If that sounds like that's interesting to you, please check out the Skeptico forum, which you can find through the website. I have a number of really cool shows coming up. I do hope you stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.